two others, but we're coming in. We were in the middle of chapter 7 last week on the dialectic of community. And with the notes that I distributed for last week were on page 3 at number, beginning of number 10. The dialectic of community, again, is the dialectic, the two principles of the dialectic of community are the spontaneous intersubjectivity of people in groups and the practical common sense of people working out technological, economic, and political systems and structures. So it's there's a tension then, a tension between proclivities of intersubjective spontaneity, togetherness, and so on and so forth, and the systems that must be set up in order to get things done, political, economic, technological systems. Now, what prevents, beginning with number 10 from those notes from last week, what prevents this unity from functioning as a as an integral dialectic is our various forms of bias. In chapter 6, we saw dramatic bias, the psychic bias that is frequently induced in people by circumstances beyond their own control. But in chapter 7, there are discussed three other forms that bias can take, and these three other forms influence primarily the community. They distort primarily the community. The psychic bias, the dramatic bias, has its effect primarily on the individual. But while these biases are in individuals, their predominant effect is on the social order in one form or another. So he talks about individual or egoistic bias, group bias, and general bias. Section 6 of chapter 7 is on individual bias. Individual bias is the interference of self-centered spontaneity, both with the intelligence that sponsors the good of order, the systems that we need in order to have a well-functioning society. So both with that practical common sense and with the spontaneous intersubjectivity that leads us to help others in the attainment of their satisfaction. So the individual bias is attacks both of those principles. It's the bias of the egoist, as it's described there on page 245, with remarkable acumen, one solves one's own problems. With startling modesty, one does not venture to raise the relevant further questions. Can one's solution be generalized? Is it compatible with the social order that exists? Is it compatible with any social order that proximately or even remotely is possible? If you're familiar with Kant's ethics, his ethics, his categorical imperative, is basically that the moral deed must be capable of generalization. It must be something that everyone could subscribe to. And what Lonergan's talking about here with individual bias is a bias against even raising that question of whether the solution that I have to my own problem is one that is good for the social order. The egoist uses intelligence but restrains inquiry to the field determined by self-centered desires and fears. One thus excludes correct understanding of oneself and of situations, since it is only through the cumulative process of further questions and further insights that an adequate understanding is reached. The egoist is not unaware of self-deception because it is by a conscious self-orientation that one devotes one's energies to playing the social order to one's own advantage, the operator, the con artist, and so on and so forth. The egoist's uneasy conscience is one's awareness of one's sin against the light. Operative within us, there is the eros of the mind, the desire and drive to understand. The egoist knows its value, for he or she gives it free rein where their own interests are concerned. That they also repudiate its mastery, for they will not grant serious consideration to its further relevant questions. So that's the first form of bias that can distort the dialectic of community, the bias of the individual. And that bias actually goes counter to both of the principles that set up a well-functioning community. It interferes with the spontaneous intersubjectivity that makes us want to be with others and promote their good as well as our own, and it interferes with the practical common sense that sets up the institutions whereby the community can function in a way that is good to, for all. Now, group bias is a second form, and group bias is the interference of the intersubjective, narrow intersubjectivity, the intersubjectivity of one's own group, one's own class, whatever it might happen to be. I think Lonergan picked up a lot from Marx on group bias. Marx is the class theory of society. Because remember that part that I quoted, which did not appear in the final manuscript, but at this part he's dealing with, he's addressing some of the concerns that were raised by Marx. Group bias is an interference of narrow intersubjectivity with the development of practical common sense. Right? So that's intersubjectivity stopping the ideas that could lead to technological, economic, and or political improvement, and particularly economic and political improvement for the good of all. Individual bias leads to attitudes that conflict with ordinary common sense, but group bias actually operates in the genesis of the common sense of different classes, so different groups are formed as a result of a bias that favors the advantage of one's own group. There's some very good descriptions, I think, that he gives of this on 248 and 249. Social progress is a succession of changes. Each new idea gradually modifies the social situation to call forth further new ideas and bring about still further modifications. Moreover, the new ideas are practical. They are applicable to concrete situations. They occur to those engaged in the situations to which they are to be applied. However, while the practical common sense of a community may be a single whole, its parts reside separately in the minds of members of social groups, and its development occurs as each group intelligently responds to the succession of situations with which it immediately deals. Were all the responses made by pure intelligences, continuous progress might be inevitable. That is to say, there wouldn't be something stopping the flow of question and answer. But in fact, responses are made by intelligences that are coupled with the ethos and the interests of groups. And while intelligence may head for change, group spontaneity does not, at least always, regard all changes in the same cold light of the general good of society, of the whole society. Just as the individual egoist puts further questions up to a point, but desists before reaching conclusions incompatible with egoism, so also the group is prone to have a blind spot for the insights that reveal its well-being to be excessive or its usefulness at an end. And so we have the divisions within the societies of classes, the rich and the poor, and so on and so forth. You're going to have to bear with me today. I'm getting over a cold and my throat gets very dry. I'm just every little bit of speaking. Group bias thus leads to a bias in the generative principle of a developing social order. That generative principle is the succession of new ideas. Okay? Now, there's a bias in that. Because of group bias, even truly practical ideas have to be divided into operative and inoperative ideas. Ideas are operative. What makes them operative? When they're backed by power. Ideas are operative only when they either meet with no group resistance or else find favor with powerful groups. And so you've got groups setting off against one another. The resultant bias in social development is described on page 249. The bias of development involves a distortion. The advantage of one group commonly is disadvantageous to another. And so some part of the energies of all groups is devoted to the supererogatory activity of devising and implementing offensive and defensive mechanisms. How do we keep them from coming up with another idea that will offset this idea that we want for our own advantage and that sort of thing? Groups differ in their possession of native talent, opportunities, initiative, resources. Those in favored circumstances find success the key to still further success. Those unable to make operative the new ideas that are to their advantage fall behind in the process of social development. Society becomes stratified. Its flower is far in advance of average attainment. Its roots appear to be the survival of the rude achievement of a forgotten age. Classes become distinguished not merely by social function, but also by social success. And the new differentiation finds expression not only in conceptual labels, but also in deep feelings of frustration, resentment, bitterness, and hatred. And you have the conflict in a society of, obviously he's talking here primarily about the rich and the poor and what happens. And it's the rich who have the power behind, so their ideas get implemented. No matter how practical the ideas favoring the well-being of those who are disadvantaged, relatively disadvantaged, because of group bias, if they don't have the power behind that, there's the problem and they fall further and further. Moreover, the course of development has been twisted. The social order that has been realized does not correspond to any coherently developed set of practical ideas. It represents the fraction of practical ideas that were made operative by their conjunction with power, the mutilated remnants of once excellent schemes that issued from the mill of compromise, the otiose structures that equipped groups for their offensive and defensive activity. So much of political activity is this sort of. Again, ideas are general, but the stratification of society into the different groups depending on their relative success, social success, has blocked their realization in their proper generality. Ideas possess retinues of complementary ideas that add further adjustments and improvements, but these needed complements were submitted to the sifting of group interests and to the alterations of compromise. That's the second of the biases that can interfere with the well-being and the development of the community. The group bias that plays on the development of the intersubjective for the advantage of one's own class or group. But group bias creates the principles for the reversal of aberration. This is what's been going on, if I may speak for a moment, in our local political situation in the last several months. We've had the reversal, the shorter cycle, what is referred to as the shorter cycle in the evolution of society, is making a turn right now, and a dramatic turn from one situation into another now. Whether it will succeed or not is another question, but the reversal is beginning to take place in my view. What originally was a neglected possibility in time becomes a grotesquely distorted reality as the society becomes more and more stratified and as the situation becomes more and more absurd. And the sentiments of the unsuccessful can be crystallized into militant force by the crusading of a reformer or a revolutionary. There's Martin King, there's Nelson Mandela, and Gandhi, but we also have at a less dramatic level the sorts of things that happen as political changes, effective political changes take place. The conflict, depending on how serious it is, or the seriousness of the conflict, rather, depends on the attitude of the dominant groups. The more reactionary the dominant group, the more the steam builds up in the oppressed. The more progressive the dominant group, and the more open they are, the more liberal they are, the more ready to make changes, then the less violent is going to be the upheaval in the righting of the situation. Okay, any questions up to that point? It's just an analysis of how different forms of bias influence in a distorting way the unfolding of society.
I'm not sure of the question, but the power play that sort of even controls the group bias, how would Lonergan situate this force, this power that underlies the bias to take control? I'm not sure if I'm...
You mean the power itself, the drive
power
to power,
itself,
the will to power?
Yeah. It sort of, but that influences... the dominance of the bias. I'm not sure if I'm...
Yeah, I think I know what you're asking. Why do people want to dominate? Is that what you're asking? Why is there the will to dominance? Or maybe
no, not quite, no.
Okay, right.
I don't know, maybe the source of the power, or where would Lloyd-Mann situate the power play itself as sort of being the catalyst for the bias to
develop?
Move forward, to develop.
To keep.
And to take control of the.
It's in the narrow scope of the designs upon the social order on the part of the group that is powerful enough to affect how the social order evolved. So it's in their the way in which they're able to manipulate the forces in the society in such a way as to keep the society functioning for their own advantage and the disadvantage of those who are outside their circle. So it's the various offensive and defensive mechanisms. And they use their intelligence for that, but rather than for promoting the common good of the whole society. The intelligence is manipulative, it's instrumental for the sake of building up their own well-being. Am I addressing the question? I don't know whether I'm hitting it or not. Maybe I'm not getting the question.
I'm not getting the question, but...
Is there an example that you're thinking of?
I mean, like, if you, like, say, a minority group,
yeah.
Let's say, a rich group, they are rich and they're able to dominate the way things progress according to their own biases.
Yeah.
But here, I suppose, the power would be the richness that they have,
yeah,
the wealth.
The power there in many instances is in money.
Yeah. So, and that, I think, maybe what I'm asking is that, isn't that power also part of the bias, the general group, the group bias that perpetuates whatever orientation that the group takes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's exponential. You know, and the more longer it goes on, the more the power develops, and the harder it is to break it.
Mm.
Sean,
I think my question's equally on form, so let's see if
I
can see certain strands of postmodernism, of Foucault, especially some feminism. Strains of feminism that would say basically group bias is culture,
mm-hmm.
in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, group bias as it relates to the form of common sense, like we talked about a couple weeks ago, is basically the way a group of people sort of identify,
mm-hmm.
and almost in the way culture forms.
Right.
Then, if group bias is inherent to the formation of common sense,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. Is that?
Yeah, okay. No, it's not, on this analysis, it's not inherent. It doesn't have to happen.
It doesn't have to.
Marx would say the same thing. Culture is group bias, or group bias.
That's
culture.
What I think.
Marx would say that, too.
Okay.
That all culture, except a Marxist culture, is an inauthentic reflex of political group interest.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Group interest. Yeah.
Is a way of thinking of the dialectic of community in a pluralistic culture, really, it's the dialectic of cultures. It's the dialectic of different groups trying to form
a
community.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
In a multicultural society, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would be that. In other words, this becomes complexified into various intersubjective groups interacting with the technological, economic, and political structure that is common to all of them.
So community then becomes almost a higher viewpoint to culture.
That's good. That's good. Yeah. Okay.
sure how legitimate this question is, but I'm wondering.
You're all apologizing.
I'm really wondering at how conscious this process is.
A lot of it is spontaneous. Okay, it's conscious, but it's not. A lot of it is not deliberate until it's called to people's attention that this is what's happening, and then they can catch it and they can make a decision with regard to it. You know, but this is spontaneous. This kind of thing happens spontaneously. But it is conscious. Consciousness. Well, we haven't really gotten to the notion of consciousness yet in Wanderer, but consciousness is self-presence.
Okay.
That's all. It's not, consciousness is not knowing. So I don't know that this is going on. And once I know that it's going on, then I've got the capacity to make a decision about it. But I don't know it. It's just, there's an awareness here. It's not like the rolling of a stone, you know? There is an awareness, but it's self-present. It's not known until it's pointed out, until some social analysis is done on it. And we'll come to this with the general bias kind of thing, because general bias, which is what we're going to take next, is the resistance to the kind of analysis that's necessary in order to point out to a society what is going on. Okay, but there's a resistance to that, because you've got to move into theory, you've got to face long-term consequences of your actions, and so on. People don't want to do that. But we'll see in greater detail when we get to later on in the book the distinction between consciousness and knowledge. Consciousness is simply self-presence. It's simply awareness. And knowledge is a lot more than that. Knowledge is experience, understanding, judgment. Knowing what's going on and being conscious as things are going on are two very different things.
So up to this point, it's just an experience?
Up to this point, what he's talking about is what are some of the dynamics that function in a society? And up to this point, he's talking more or less about how societies develop more or less spontaneously, experientially in that sense. So that intelligence is operative, but it's operative. Under the narrow constraints that are introduced by these, by different prejudices, biases, whatever, so it's narrowed down, okay, and people are not always aware, as aware as they might be of what's happening until it's pointed out, until some analysis is done. And I think maybe the material and general bias might fill out a little bit more of what you get at. So perhaps let's move to that. More serious still is the role of general bias. We're all prone to it. People can be well developed in the sense that they might not have much of a problem with a psychic or dramatic bias or an individual bias or even a group bias. They might be critical. Critical enough of and open enough and generous enough that they're not going to want to hoard the well-being of the society into their own group. But general bias affects even a common sense that is free of dramatic individual and group bias. That should be group bias in that sentence there. I just noticed that now in the second line of number 14. It affects even a common sense that is free of dramatic individual and group bias. General bias is the propensity of common sense to extend its legitimate concern for the concrete and the immediately practical into the disregard of larger issues and indifference to long-term results. As John Maynard Keynes quoted somebody saying about the economic process, in the long term, we're not going to be concerned about the long term because in the long term we're all dead. That's something to be concerned about. Common sense is incapable of analyzing itself. This, I think, is what perhaps you were getting at. It's incapable of analyzing itself. It needs something more for that analysis. It needs human science, it needs philosophy, whatever. It can't analyze itself. It's incapable of making the discovery that it, too, is a specialized development of human knowledge. Incapable of coming to grasp that its peculiar nature is to extend its legitimate concern for the concrete and the immediately practical into disregard of larger issues and indifference to long-term results. Ultimate questions, theory, those are the things that there's resistance to. The reaction of a lot of people against the ecological discoveries that are made, the people still laughing at that, because that's those scientists, you know. What do they know? So section 8.1 on the longer cycle. So here we're dealing with different cycles in human history. There are shorter cycles that are generated by group bias. And they turn upon ideas that are neglected by dominant groups only to be championed later by the oppressed groups. These ideas have to do basically with material well-being. So what's for the good of the different groups within the society? Okay, those cycles are relatively short. They may seem awfully long as you're going through them, but they're shorter compared to the longer cycles characterized by the neglect of ideas to which all groups are rendered indifferent by general. Eric Vogelin once asked the question, why is it that the most important issues for human living are raised and faced only by philosophers and saints? And that it takes tremendous effort to raise those efforts, to raise the common consciousness of human beings to those questions. Why is that? Because we're all prone to neglect those issues, the issues of ultimate meaning and value, long-term consequences of our actions, and the larger issues and the theoretical issues that sometimes are required in order to solve our problems. So we can discover emergent probability. So we can discover that the actions that we do now set the conditions for the actions that will happen later. We can work out the manner in which prior insights and decisions, our decisions now, determine the possibilities and probabilities of later insights and decisions. So what we do now has an effect on what's going to be possible in the future. We can do that individually, we can do it as a group. We can guide our present decisions in the light of their influence on future insights and decisions. Finally, this control of the emergent probability of the future can be exercised not only by the individual in choosing a career and informing one's character, not only by adults in educating the younger generation, but also by humankind in its consciousness of its responsibility to the future of humankind. So we can set the conditions now for the emergence of better schemes in the future, both in our own living and in the history of our group, and ultimately, and particularly today, when everything is on a global scale, the future of humanity. But this means that common sense is not enough. Common sense of itself cannot guide human history. It has to aim at being subordinated to a human science that thinks on the level of history. It cannot realize ideas that suppose a long view or set up a higher integration, or involve the solution of intricate and disputed issues. The challenge of history is for us progressively to restrict the realm of chance, or fate, or destiny, and progressively to enlarge the realm of conscious grasp and deliberate choice. Common sense accepts the challenge, but it does so only partially. It needs to be guided, but it is incompetent to choose its guide. Becomes involved in incoherent enterprises. It is subjected to disasters that no one expects, that remain unexplained even after their occurrence, that can be explained only on the level of scientific or philosophic thought, that even when explained can be prevented from recurring only by subordinating common sense to a higher specialization of human intelligence.
Don? I was just wondering if I could get an example of longer cycle of decline. I think I've got the shorter cycle now.
It would be the resistance to Why do societies die? Why do organizations die? I'm thinking of, well, I have to be careful here, but if the realm of the ultimate is neglected in any kind of group or community or religious group or whatever, and the concerns become simply the maintenance of the current status quo, rather than the issue of what do we really want, and how are we going to get there? And it's the neglect of those questions. I don't want to give the examples that I'm thinking of right now because they're a little bit too current. But if a group neglects its heritage, neglects the founding inspiration behind it. So you've got Lonergan in a lot of his later papers quotes the same quotation over and over again. Kierkegaard asking about that to be a Christian is not simply to be baptized in a community. It's a whole set of needs. And if a whole community neglects those and simply accepts the formalized, ritualized membership, that was part of Kierkegaard's problem with the National Church of Denmark. That people were they were part of a formalized, ritualized community, but they had neglected what was the original. Plato and Aristotle both, Vogelin's studies of Plato and Aristotle in the third volume of his Order in History, he maintains that the philosophy for Plato was basically an act of social resistance to corruption in the polis, in the city-state. And that Plato was the one who saw effective resistance had to turn to the realm of, had to go through what in Greek was called a periagoge, a conversion, a complete turnaround. And no matter what we might think of some of the influences of the Platonic heritage, I mean, basically what he was doing was focusing, focusing attention on the ultimate issues, without attention to which a society would not. It's a hard thing to grasp.
It's an interesting example. I'm just finishing up Copleston's Ancient History.
Right.
It struck me how these various Greek philosophers all almost automatically got pulled into politics. Like their gifts were immediately brought into politics. Contrast to today, where politics is a magnet for inauthenticity.
That's the kind of thing that's getting at. That if the pursuits of the artists and the philosophers and the saints are not heard at the level where the decisions are being made in the society, the society is sooner or later going to die. Without the pursuit of the beautiful, the intelligible, the true, and the good, the society will not. And if that cannot be embodied in the cultural institutions of the society, but it's over a long, much longer cycle than the power plays of the groups for their advantages. Sheldon?
Does Lonergan allow for, I guess, what might appear as general bias, but is, I don't know what to call it other than a legitimate critique of theory, in that some people are resistant to theory because they know it's incomplete. And so I kind of like the idea of division of powers in the United States originally, where they just said, look, nobody knows the answers here, and if we don't do something to prevent somebody from taking, from forcing their will on everybody, it's going to go bad.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, so that's not, I don't know what that is, but that's like, that's almost like saying, instead of a model of evolution as being progress,
mm-hmm.
it's adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
Right, things are going to change. Nobody can really tell where this thing is supposed to go. Therefore, we don't want to put all our eggs in one basket. I mean, it seems like there's an argument against some of what he's saying here that could be legitimate, but is not necessarily biased. It's an informed argument against cooperating with a system. Systematic approach to this.
Okay. I think the main point that he's saying is that there are certain problems that will not be resolved unless we are willing to listen to the people who are capable of meeting us. Take the ecological issue today, for instance. That without the scientific pursuit that can get to the bottom of this and whatever that might be, it's not going to be settled. And to laugh at and ridicule what the ecological scientists are coming up with would be a part of what he's talking about here, of the bias against that.
Sure. So no, and I recognize that there is a like he, but he's saying that all the resistance to that is because we're biased towards common sense and not the long term. But there's also a view, I think, and it might not be so much this. I think of, you know, like people who resisted some of the ideas in third world development in the 60s, which it turns out from the longer point of view we find were not good things to do. But, you know, because our theory isn't developed enough that we understand the consequences of our actions. So there is some legitimate reason.
I see what you're getting at there. But then the thing is that you know, then part of what has to be done is to improve the theory.
I agree. But it's just like... You know,
and as long as you agree with that, then, I mean... I think what he's saying would have no argument with what you're saying. That as long as you don't reject all theoretical
all
pursuit because the present theory is inadequate.
Right.
Yeah. It's like Gutierrez's comment that apparently had an effect on Lonergan after he had finished his work on metaphysical theology, that Gutierrez was saying that the economic theories that were determining life in Latin America, both Marxism and North American capitalism, were inadequate. And he was pleading with North Americans, who still had a certain amount of leisure, to come up with something better. Not to abandon economic theory, but
to
improve it. So, but there is a tendency on the part of people who say, well, the theory is bad, to say then, therefore, that all theory is bad. And that's the easy. That's what he's getting at. That's what he's attempting to get at. Yes.
What an example of what Sheldon is talking about here is that the notion that where bias can become organic in that sense, where people can't, where maybe even organic isn't the right word, but it's like these people had a hunch. I don't know the answer to the question, but I know that what we're going to do here, like in terms of third world development, it might lead to dangerous implications. But I can't see that. Or is that what you're...
But even more, I mean, there is, whatever you want to call it, there's the libertarian movement in the United States, and I guess to some extent here in Canada, that says, we don't want big government because you can't know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know. It's not just a question of social progress, marching towards social progress. The environment changes. I mean, they're outside. It's not a closed system. There are all kinds of things that are happening that are outside the system. And if I put all my eggs in one basket, the probability that I'm going to be right is almost negligible. So they create structures to prevent what would appear to be progress, what you might take as progress, simply because they know they need to keep their options open.
Oh, that's not at all what I...
But that's a different approach to I mean, it's, I don't know if it's denial of progress or it's a different approach towards, it's saying that, you know, towards progress or.
I think Lonergan calls it obscurantism, doesn't he?
Well, if it's neglecting questions, if it's rejecting questions, that's what he would call it.
Libertines in the States are crazy. I mean, I don't know how they are in Canada, but I'm sorry.
I won't argue there, but I mean, there is a view there. And there is a different view of evolution, that evolution is not necessarily progressing to anywhere in particular.
Yeah.
It's a question of adapting to what happens. I mean, things change. Technology changes. Your ability to interact, the number of players changes. And so a lot of things that might appear to be a social regression, it's because things have changed. The society itself, the things that I'm playing with have changed. Right? So it's...
I hear what you're saying. Like, to me, though, when I'm reading this, I get the idea that the system is open, in the sense that you're constantly on the look for new questions arise, and you deal with them as they arise.
But for instance, if a society, if I'm talking about a city, and I run out of arable land, a community that runs out of arable land, well, I've got a very different reality, and my social structures are all going to change. It may appear to be, you know, a less equitable form of organization or something, but it's not simply a question of the biases of groups. It's a question that the environment changes. The environment has changed, and that's gonna cause change in society. Which, you know, there's all of those things that are causing changes, as well as just the conflict between them.
Sure.
Okay, but now in this section he's not talking so much about the conflict between the groups, but rather take the question that you just raised, and how deeply are people willing to go into the issues that are raised by that environmental change? You know, that's the kind of thing. Are they going to shut off the questioning too quickly, or are they going to pursue it to the point where the adaptation can be to the well-being of the whole society? And that might take more than common sense is capable of. That's all he's saying.
Well, so I agree that all of this takes more than common sense is capable of.
That's the big thing that he's saying here is that many human problems cannot be resolved by common sense, that they demand the input of theory and science and philosophy and so on, for the sake of the well-being of the community. All right, let's see if we, where are we with regard to the chapter? Let's see if we can finish this chapter before we take a break. I'm going to have to sit down before we run. So number 16 here, the implications of the longer cycle, just quoting from page 254. The general bias of common sense involves the disregard of timely and fruitful ideas, and this disregard not only excludes their implementation, but also deprive subsequent stages of the further ideas to which they would give rise, and of the correction that they and their retinue would bring to the ideas that are implemented. And the result, then, is a sequence of ever less comprehensive viewpoints and integrations of human living as this happens. Three consequences follow. First of all, there is a cumulative deterioration of the social situation. Secondly, the mounting irrelevance of culture, religion, and philosophy because of the social surd. What is the social surd? This is the first time he's introduced that term here. It's an increasingly significant residue in society that is imminent in the social facts, is not intelligible, yet cannot be abstracted from if one is to consider the facts as in fact they are. And thirdly, the third consequence, the surrender of intelligence itself, both on the level of common sense and on the speculative or superstructural level of the society, where it becomes radically uncritical, non-normative, non-dialectical, and in the limit totalitarian. And then his description of the totalitarian society. On the totalitarian view, every type of intellectual independence, whether personal, cultural, scientific, philosophic, or religious, has no better basis than non-conscious myth. And so for the totalitarian, the time has come for the conscious myth that will secure our total subordination to the requirements of reality. What is reality? The economic development, the military equipment, and the political dominance of the all-inclusive state. Its ends justify all means. Its means include not merely every technique of indoctrination and propaganda, every tactic of economic and diplomatic pressure, every device for breaking down the moral conscience and exploiting the secret affects of civilized humanity, but also the terrorism of a political police, prisons and torture of concentration camps of transported or extirpated minorities, and of total war. The succession of less comprehensive viewpoints has been a succession of adaptations of theory to practice. In the limit, practice becomes a theoretically unified whole, and theory is reduced to the status of a myth that lingers on to represent the frustrated aspirations of detached and disinterested intelligence. If this bias remains effective, if there are not the creative minority to call people back to the real questions, the result is complete disintegration and decay. But this is not inevitable. The essential logic of the distorted dialectic is a reversal. The dialectic rests on the concrete unity of opposed principles. The dominance of either principle results in a distortion, and the distortion both weakens the dominance and strengthens the opposed principle to restore an equilibrium. The alternative, however, to general bias, whereas with group bias it's just to get another group in power, whereas the alternative to general bias involves the attainment of a higher viewpoint, higher than common sense, in our understanding and making of ourselves, and also of a higher integration in our very being, as will become obvious in later chapters in the book. For the moment, this higher viewpoint is described in the following terms: the discovery, the logical expansion, and the recognition of the principle that intelligence contains its own immanent norms, and that these norms are equipped with sanctions which we do not have to invent or impose. In other words, we must face the further relevant questions, and if we don't, and we continue to resist facing the further relevant questions, it will lead to cumulative disintegration. What this would mean entails at least the following: acknowledging that the principle of progress is liberty, the principle of decline is bias, that human science, think of political science, economics, sociology, must be not only empirical — empirical is just a description of what is — but also critical, normative, and dialectical. Culture must be granted an autonomous place in the structure of society, an independent factor that passes a detached yet effective judgment upon capital formation and technology, upon economy and polity. Culture is not a tool that serves these, but rather something that can pass judgment on them. The mentality that supports, sustains, and promotes this higher viewpoint, Lonergan calls a cosmopolis, that is neither class nor state. It's a mentality now. Cosmopolis is a very profound idea. It's a mentality that stands above all the claims of classes and states, cuts them down to size. It's founded on the native detachment and disinterestedness of every intelligence. It commands our first allegiance, that implements itself primarily through that allegiance, that is too universal to be bribed, too impalpable to be forced, too effective to be ignored. Cosmopolis is concerned to make operative the timely and fruitful ideas that otherwise are inoperable. So far from employing power or pressure or force, it has to witness to the possibility of ideas being operative without such backing. And it's in general, it's the stance.